You're listening to After the Storm, where the healing begins on UK Health Radio. I'm Brian D. Smith, founder of Grief to Growth and a certified grief guide, life coach, and author. This part of my journey began after the passing of my 15-year-old daughter, Shayna, so I'm doing the work too. Each week, we explore the journey through grief, not just surviving loss, but discovering who you're becoming on the other side of it. This is where the healing begins. If you've been with me for these past 9 episodes, you know I don't hand you anything I haven't tested myself first. We've covered a lot of ground together, what grief actually is, how it expands you instead of shrinking you down to a smaller version of who you were, what your body goes through when you lose someone, the science of it, not just the poetry of it, what happens when you sit in stillness instead of running from it, with Kelvin Chen's Turning Within method, and then in the last episode, the evidence. The real examined decades-deep evidence that consciousness survives death. Here's something about me you should know if you don't already. When someone hands me a theory, no matter how compelling it sounds, no matter how many letters a person has after their name, I have one question I ask before I decide how much weight I give it, how much space it's going to take up in my life. And that question is, so what? What difference does this actually make for my life? And I want you to sit with that question for a second, because it's not cynicism, it's actually the opposite. It's respect for the theory. If an idea is true, it should be able to survive contact with an actual life. If it can't, it wasn't worth much to begin with. I spent decades reading the research before Shayna passed. Near-death experience studies, mediumship research, the rigorous kind, not the stage show kind. Consciousness philosophy, I could have debated any of it with you over coffee, calmly from a safe distance. And then my daughter passed, and every bit of that theory I dragged out of the books and tested against the worst thing that's ever happened to me. That's when the so what question became real. And here's where I learned in that test. Knowing something intellectually and living it are two completely different things. The research I had done couldn't do the grieving for me. It didn't get me out of bed. It didn't sit with me in the car when I couldn't breathe. I had to take everything I had studied for 20 years and turn it into something I could actually use, something to do with my hands in the morning, something to reach for my worst moments behind the wheel, something to say to the people around me who had no idea what to say to me. So today, we're not going to add any more theory to the pile. You've got plenty of theory from me already. Today is the so what. Welcome to After the Storm. I'm going to walk you through 4 things, how your daily practices change and why the change matters more than the practice itself. What to do when a trigger levels you out of nowhere with no warning and no mercy. How to talk to the people around you when they don't know what to say to you. And honestly, half the time, you don't know what to say back. And how the evidence we spent last episode building stops being an idea you nod along to and starts being something you actually live inside of every single day. And I want to say one more thing before we dive in too deep, because I don't want you to hear practical and think that means clinical or detached or some kind of checklist you run through like you're troubleshooting a printer. Grief isn't a problem to fix. What I'm handing you today isn't a cure. It's closer to what a physical therapist gives you after an injury. Not something that makes the injury never have happened, but something that helps you carry the weight of it and keep moving without pretending that the injury isn't there. So there are 4 pieces. Let's get into it. I want to start with something simple, because grief doesn't ask you to overhaul your entire life overnight. Nobody hands you a binder on day 1 that says, here's your new personality. It asks you to change small things quietly and let them mean something new. Before Shayna passed, I walked most mornings. It was exercise. Get the steps in, clear my head a little, start the day with some momentum. It was a health habit, the kind any doctor would approve of. And honestly, I didn't think much about it beyond that. But after Shayna passed, the walks got longer. Not really because I planned that way. It just happened. I walk out to the door meaning to do my usual loop, and I find myself still walking 20 minutes past where I normally turned around. And somewhere in those longer walks, the purpose changed completely. It stopped being about my heart rate and started being a spiritual practice. It was time to talk to her. It was time to notice things. A bird landing somewhere it had no business landing. A particular slant of the sun coming through the trees during sunrise early in the morning. And wonder, without ever needing an answer, if that's her saying good morning to me. I don't walk to get somewhere anymore. I walk to be with her. The distance is almost beside the point now. I'm not telling you this because I think a longer walk is going to fix your grief. I'm telling you because the shift and the purpose is the actual medicine, not the steps. You can take the exact same walk you've always taken and turn it into something sacred just by deciding that that's what it is. For me, I would leave the house in the morning and I would envision every step as like a day in my life. And I envision my leaving the house and returning to the house as the entirety of my life, walking, stepping, and then coming back to where I started. And that vision helped me to get through understanding that one step at a time, one day at a time, I'm going to get back to where I need to be. That's when that walk became more than just a daily loop and turned into a spiritual practice. My meditation practice deepened also in a very similar way. If you caught the episode I did about turning within meditation practice, you know that I don't treat stillness as an escape hatch from grief. A lot of people come to meditation wanting it to make the pain go away. And that was me, frankly, at the beginning. And when it doesn't, they quit. But that's not what meditation is for, at least not for me. Actually, now it's where I go to feel what I'm feeling on my own terms, instead of having it ambush me somewhere inconvenient. My meditation practice is where I get in touch with myself, my own inner self, and get to know myself. Grief is going to find you regardless of what you do. Meditation is where I choose to let it find me, sitting down, breathing, safe, instead of letting it catch me off guard in a grocery store aisle, which trust me, it will do if you never give it anywhere else to land. And then there's a ritual I want to specifically recommend to you because I think it's one of the most powerful and overlooked things you can do, especially if you're struggling with your home right now. And that is build an altar. Now, stay with me. That may not be what it sounds like. But if you've lost someone in your house to a traumatic event, you may feel uncomfortable in your own home. If you feel like your home is empty, devoid of your person, you may feel uncomfortable being in that place where you spent so much time with them. There may be that the room you can't walk by without your chest tightening. There may be a place where when you're in that particular room where you just feel like it's just empty and sad. So it may just be quieter than it should be, missing a voice that used to hold. Either one of these things can make your own home not feel like the sanctuary that's always been to you. Now back to this altar thing. It doesn't have to be something elaborate, and it's certainly not religious. And it doesn't need anyone else's permission to exist. You can put it wherever you want and put whatever you want on it. It could be a photo. It could be something that they touched that was close to them, something that still smells like them if you're early enough on in this, a candle that you light on hard days or every day if that's what you need. What it does is it practically gives you a physical space to invite their presence back in, instead of a house that feels like it's only full of absence. It gives your grief somewhere to go that isn't just wherever happens to ambush you. So I'll give you a little bit more detail. I'll tell you about my altar. It's where I would sit on the floor and meditate. I have a meditation cushion, and I bought a little meditation altar. It's a table. It's about probably 6 inches high. And on that altar, I put a friend of mine after Shayna passed, created a keepsake box that she painted very nicely, and she put 4 heart-shaped stones in it that she had found to represent the 4 people in our family, myself, my wife, my daughter Kayla, and my daughter Shayna. In that box, if I find coins or feathers, I put them into that box. So that's sitting on my altar. I have Shayna's glasses that she wore. That's my reminder of Shayna. I have little trinkets I picked up along the way. Things like Buddha statues, also a statue of Lord Krishna that my daughter Kayla gave me. I've got a Jizo statue that I picked up in a little shop here in town. And it's kind of funny, when I picked it up, I thought it was a cute little Buddha statue, and I brought it home and I put it on my altar. And then I did some research on it. And I found that it was actually a Japanese figure named Jizo who's a person that guides lost children home. And it's just interesting. I happened to pick that up thinking it was a cute little Buddha statue. So whatever it is that works for you, that just lets you know that your person not only still belongs here, your person still is here. If you live with someone else, this could become a shared space. It doesn't have to be for yours only. So you can talk to your other kids or your spouse or whatever that lives with you and say, what would you like to go on this? This little place to represent our loved one. Also, a friend of mine, after Shayna passed, she took pictures of Shayna. She'd actually pulled off of Facebook and she made them into a beautiful display. And we've got that actually in our kitchen. My altar I mentioned earlier is in my bedroom. But we've got a little memory place in the kitchen that's got pictures of Shayna. And we have penguins because she loved penguins, those types of things, in that same area. So the same thing goes for meditation. If you've never really done it before and the word intimidates you, I want to say this. You don't need an app. You don't need a cushion. And you don't need 20 minutes of silence that you may not think you have. Even a minute and a half of just sitting still and breathing on purpose counts. The goal isn't to achieve some enlightened state. The goal is to give grief a scheduled appointment so it stops showing up uninvited quite as often. Now, none of this, the walk, the meditation, the altar, is about staying stuck in the past. I want to be really clear about that because I know some of you have people in your life who worry that talking to a photograph or lengthening your grief walks means you're not moving forward. It's actually the opposite. It's about building a structure that makes room for them to stay close. It's not about pretending that they aren't gone physically, but it's also not about acting like they need to be forgotten before you're allowed to live again. You can do both. You can move forward with them. You can live again, and you can keep them in your memories and in your heart. That's the whole point of everything we're covering today. Those three practices, the walk, the stillness of the meditation, the altar, they aren't the only ones out there. And they don't have to be yours exactly as I've described them. These are some examples of where it works for me. What matters is the underlying move, taking something ordinary and letting grief repurpose it into something sacred. Maybe for you, it's cooking a dish that they used to make. Maybe it's a specific chair you sit in with your coffee. The form doesn't matter nearly as much as the willingness to let it mean something. Now, thinking that I do also with Shayna, is I've got a large picture of her in my foyer, which is when I open my bedroom door in the morning, is the first thing I see. And I say good morning to her the first thing in the morning as I'm getting up to start my day. And when I'm letting my dog out at night for the last time, I say good night to her. These little rituals, as steady as they are, they don't protect you from all the moments that arrive with no ritual attached at all. Grief is still going to ambush you, especially in those early days. It's going to happen to you in the middle of an ordinary day with zero warning. And that's where we're headed next. Here's the thing that nobody tells you about triggers. And just so you know, the word trigger, I'm using it today. That word we're kind of phasing out. We're moving toward activating because the word trigger actually activates some people because of gun violence. So if that's the case with you, I apologize for using the word trigger. But I wish someone had told me about this before it happened to me. These triggers are these things that activate you. Don't wait for a convenient moment. They don't check your calendar first. I remember once I was driving to grief counseling. I want you to picture this with me for a second because I think the setting really matters. So I'm going to grief counseling and it was a beautiful day. This was the summer that Shayna passed and the summer is my favorite time of the year. Because I love the heat and I love the sun. And I'm driving there and I'm listening to music and the music was just one of those times when the sun was just right and the music was just right and I'm feeling pretty good. And I drove past a White Castle. Now, if you don't know what White Castle is, it's a regional hamburger chain restaurant here in the U.S. And they sell these little square burgers. You buy them in a bag and, you know, you eat three or four of them. I used to be able to eat 10 of them at a time, frankly, when I was younger. But I was driving there and I passed this White Castle and my thought went to the first time I'd taken my girls there, Kayla and Shayna. My wife didn't like this place, so it was just the three of us. And Shayna was 5 years old and I got 15 of these burgers and the girls, I was going to eat several of them, and the girls ended up eating as many as I did. But Shayna was about 5 years old at the time, and this place was kind of special to us. And suddenly I went from, this is a beautiful moment, to this sucks. Shayna's not here. And I'll never be happy again. And I don't want to ever see this White Castle again, because it reminded me of her. There was no warning. There was no buildup. One second I'm driving, feeling great. And the next second I'm just flattened right there at a red light on my way to grief counseling. So if that's happened to you, if grief has ambushed you at the worst possible moment during the single most mundane, unremarkable thing, I want you to hear this, because I needed someone to tell me this at that time and nobody did. That's not a setback. That's not you failing at grief. That is grief doing exactly what grief is supposed to do. It finds the places that love used to be experienced with our loved ones physically, and it reminds you that they're still there, whether you asked it to or not.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Trigger, the response to the trigger, is your body and mind responding to a connection that was and is real. Now, we talked about the body science behind this a few episodes back, how grief actually lives in your nervous system. It's not just floating around somewhere in your thoughts where you can reason your way past it if you tried hard enough. That thing that activates you is a system recognizing something. It's not malfunctioning, it's recognizing. My body remembered that White Castle before my conscious mind even caught up to why my chest just got tight. It's a reflex. And a reflex happens when your body responds to a signal before it even reaches your brain. So what do you actually do in the moment you're at the red light and it hits you? There are a few things you can do, and I want to give you something concrete here, not just comfort. First, you don't have to keep pushing through it, literally or figuratively. If you're somewhere where you can pull over, pull over. Give yourself 10 seconds. Nobody's timing you. If you can't pull over, you're in traffic, you're at work, you're in the middle of a conversation, breathe through it. Long exhale, longer than your inhale. Now, that's physiology. This is not just something I'm telling you to do to placate you. A longer exhale is what actually tells your nervous system it's safe to come back down out of that spike that you just felt. And say something to yourself out loud if you're alone, silently if you're not. Something like, this is grief. This is love. I don't have to fix this right now. Now, you're not trying to talk yourself out of the feeling, and you certainly don't want to fight it. What you're doing is you're naming it, so it doesn't feel like it's coming out of nowhere and taking over. A named thing is easier to sit with than an unnamed thing is to fight off. And I'm going to say this because I think it really needs to be said over and over again. No matter when this is happening to you, you are not behind schedule. There's no chart somewhere that says by month 6, you shouldn't be flattened by a fast food restaurant anymore. You're not doing this wrong. Something triggering you is not proof that you haven't healed enough, or that your counseling isn't working, or that you're somehow stuck. It's proof that you have that love for that person enough for their absence to still reach you years later at a red light, over hamburgers, whatever. That's not you being weak. That's the receipt for how much that person mattered to you. I want to talk about this for a second, because something that activates you or something that triggers you doesn't have to always trigger you or activate you. That White Castle I talked about is right around the corner from where I live. I still drive by it all the time, but the meaning of it has changed for me now. When I see it now, I have a smile on my face because I remember that time with Kayla and Shane in that restaurant with fondness. The Taco Bell that's right behind it, another place that my wife didn't really care to go to, and I went to with Shane after Kayla had gone to college. It was a special place just for Shane and I. That Taco Bell has a different meaning for me now. If you have something that's activating you and something you have to face. And again, I also want to say this really quickly. There's nothing wrong with avoiding things that activate you in the early days. Sometimes people will tell you just push through it. If you don't have to push through it, then you don't have to do that right away. But as I said, we can reframe these things over time. I want to talk about some other types of things other than just locations. There's another kind of thing that activates us that we can actually see coming. And in some ways, these are even harder. The anniversaries, the birthdays, the holiday season. These are the date on the calendar that your body starts reacting to a week before your mind even registers why. If you've noticed yourself getting irritable, exhausted, or strangely emotional in the days leading up to a date, that matters. Your body keeps its own calendar separate from the one on the wall. Now, when Shayna first passed, she passed sometime early morning on a Wednesday. And every Wednesday was a triggering event for us for a while. And then it was the 24th of the month because she passed on June 24th. And it changes over time. But those birthdays, those anniversaries, they can be a really hard time for you. So here's something you can do. Again, we're going to be practical. You can plan for it the way you plan for anything else that really takes something out of you. If you can clear your schedule, clear your schedule. My wife and I would both take off her birthday and her angel date. So we put that on the calendar and we take that day off. Decide on that day whether you want company or you want solitude. And either one is okay. You might want to be with people you love. You might decide, especially in the early days, you want to be by yourself. I had a client that after her son passed away, she realized that first Christmas, she just did not want to be with other people. And she decided to just be by herself on that Christmas. There's nothing wrong with that. Give yourself permission to do something that honors a day instead of just surviving it. You don't have to just sit in the house in the dark with the shades pulled. You can light a candle at the altar we talked about. You can take a longer walk. You don't have to white knuckle your way through an anniversary pretending it's just an ordinary day. I have a client that her son loved dogs. So she took some of his friends on his birthday and they went to a local shelter and they volunteered to walk the dogs. My wife and my daughter have done that. They've gone to a local shelter and sat with the animals because my daughter Shayna loved animals. If you want to go to the cemetery to visit the gravesite, sure, great, do that. But maybe afterwards do something fun, something that you would have done together, or your loved one would have enjoyed. See a movie that they loved or go to the restaurant you used to go to together and order their favorite dish. So I want to say this because it's easy to forget in the moment that this trigger hits you that not every trigger needs or is going to have a strategy. Sometimes the most honest thing you can do is just let it move through you completely without trying to manage it at all. I used to have panic attacks, and one of the things about panic attacks I finally learned after years and years and years was fighting them was the worst thing. It was just letting it move through me and not fighting it that finally helped me to get rid of them. So that first time at the red light by the White Castle, I didn't breathe through it gradually or say a wise sentence to myself. I just cried right there in the car until the light turned green and I had to drive again. And that counts too. You don't fail a trigger by not having the perfect response. You learn and you evolve as things go on. The tools I'm giving you are there for when you want them, not because you're required to perform coping correctly every single time grief catches you off guard. Now, here's the through line between this segment and the last one. The rituals we talked about, the walk, the altar, the meditation, those are practices that you choose on your schedule and your control. Triggers are the opposite. They choose you. And you need different tools for each. Rituals build the container. Triggers test whether the container holds. Both matter and neither one replaces the other. But there is a piece of this that no ritual and no breathing technique can fully handle on its own. And that is the people around you. Because eventually, whether you're ready or not, you have to leave the house, go back to work, sit across from family at the holiday table, figure out what to say and what to let them say back. This might be the hardest segment for me to talk about, because so much of what makes grief lonely isn't the loss itself, it's the silence that grows around it, usually built by people who love you and have absolutely no idea what they're doing. There's pressure, and you felt it, I know you have, everybody who's grieved has felt it, to be strong, to get back to normal, on a timeline that seems only exists in other people's heads. People want you functional again, and I don't think that's cruelty. I think it's discomfort. Your pain makes them uncomfortable because it reminds them that the same thing can happen to them, and the normal you is simply easier for everyone around you to be near. I want to give you permission right now, out loud, to resist that pressure. You don't owe anyone anything about recovery on their timeline. Not your boss, not your extended family, not the well-meaning neighbor who keeps asking you if you're doing better, like grief is a fever that's supposed to break. What you need instead, and this is the practical piece, is safe spaces and safe people. Not everyone in your life has earned access to your grief. You choosing those people who have earned access to your grief is not you betraying them. And frankly, them not being ready to accept your grief is not them betraying you. It may be that they just can't handle it. Some people can sit with you in the mess without flinching, without trying to fix you, without changing the subject. And this is the part that might surprise you. It surprised me. There were people in my life who I thought were going to be there through my grief who weren't, who actually left and ran out of my life. And there were people that I never expected to be there through my grief who actually stepped up and sat with me. Some people, through no real fault of their own, need you to be okay so badly that being around them costs you more than it gives you back. And if there's ever a time to be selfish, and I really push back on that word selfish because it's really important for us to take care of ourselves, but if there's ever a time to be selfish, it's when you're in grief. You have to protect your energy. You have to protect yourself. Learn the difference between people who can help you through your grief and people you're spending your energy trying to manage them. It will save you enormous amounts of energy that you don't have to spare right now. Protect that energy for the ones who can actually hold this with you. And here's something specific I want you to try and to defend, even if someone questions you about it. Talk to the person that you've, quote, lost, the person who's passed on, in the present tense. And I want to explain to you why. First of all, what I mean is not she was, she is. Not he loved, he loves. And I know that sounds like a small grammatical thing, but I promise you it's not small at all, and it's not wordplay, and it's not denial either. It's accuracy based on everything we spent in the last episode building. If love and connection don't actually end at death, then the tense you use every day should reflect what's true, not just what's easiest for other people to hear. When I talk about Shayna, I don't say she was my daughter. She is my daughter, present tense. That one word is instead of was carries almost everything I believe about what happened to her. Now, if someone corrects your grammar around your own grief, and it will happen, someone will gently was when you say is, I want you to know they're telling you more about their discomfort with the subject than they're telling you about what's actually true. Now, you don't have to argue with them. You don't have to convert them on the spot. But find the people who will let you speak about your person the way you actually experience them. And notice I said experience, not experienced them. Present, not filed away in the past like a chapter that's closed. People who've had children pass, sometimes they struggle to answer this question. How many children do you have? I want to say this clearly. For me, it's never been a struggle because I believe my daughter Shayna is still with me. And I know that Shayna, if she had a mouth to say it, would jump all over me about denying her existence as my daughter. So I always say two daughters. Now, sometimes it does get awkward if people ask questions about what do they do, where are they, et cetera. And that's when I'll go into explaining what happened to Shayna. But I never want to deny her existence or our relationship and try to just make it easier for myself or what something might come down the road by saying that I have one daughter.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The the station that makes you feel good.
I'm going to give you something practical here too, because when I say find safe people, it's easy to say and harder to actually do when you're in the middle of it. When someone asks you how you're doing and you can actually feel that they actually want the real answer, try being specific instead of defaulting to, I'm fine, or I'm doing better, or I'm doing okay. Try something like, honestly, today's hard, but I don't need you to fix it. I just wanted you to know that. Now, that sentence does two things at one time. First, it's honest, and it takes the pressure off the other person to say the perfect thing back, which is usually what's stopping people from asking in the first place. They're terrified of saying the wrong thing, so they say nothing at all. So you are saying, today's hard, you're being honest, but you're also saying, I don't need you to fix it. So you're taking that burden off of them. If you're on the other side of this, if you're the one who doesn't know what to say to someone grieving, the answer is almost always simpler than you think. You don't need the perfect words. In fact, I don't know what to say, but I'm here carries a lot. It does more good than any carefully worded speech. Grieving people can usually tell the difference between someone trying to fix them and someone just willing to sit next to them in it. Be the second kind of person. I'll add one more thing because I think it needs to be said. Setting a boundary with someone who loves you but keeps pushing you toward moving on isn't cruelty on your part, even though it might feel that way in the moment. Something as simple as saying, I know you mean well, but I need you to let me talk about her the way that I need to talk about her, is a complete sentence. You don't owe an explanation beyond that. You don't owe a debate about whether present tense is healthy. I've had grief counselors say to me that present tense isn't healthy because it delays the acceptance of the fact that the person is gone. I've had grief counselors tell me that you should just use the word dead instead of passed away or transitioned because it's plain language. And we can talk about that another time because I don't believe any of that. But you get to talk about the person the way that you want to talk about the person, the way that you experience that relationship, and the way that makes you feel comfortable. Good intentions and the right approach aren't always the same thing. And you get to be the one who decides which is which when it comes to your own grief. So everything in this particular part I'm talking about comes down to one idea. When it comes to what you say, what a lot of other people say to you, you get to decide who has access to how you talk about your person and in what tense. That's not something anyone else gets a vote on, no matter how well they mean. And that decision, insisting on present tense, insisting your person is instead of was, it's not just a preference, it's a claim about actual reality. I'm a stickler when it comes to language. I'm blessed to speak English. I don't speak any other languages, so I don't know what they're like. We have the ability to really express ourselves really, really well in this language. And I think language is important. And the tense of the verb that we use to describe the people or our relationships is important because it reflects reality and it actually affects the way that we feel and think and move and breathe. So now let's talk about living the evidence. Last episode, we walked through the evidence together, case after case, decades of research pointing toward one conclusion: consciousness survives death. If you haven't heard that episode yet, go back and listen, because everything I'm about to say builds directly on it. But today, I want to tell you what the evidence actually does to a life, because a belief that doesn't change how you live isn't worth very much to me. Remember what I said at the beginning, so what? How does this affect my life? For most of us, grief hands us a binary, and it's a lousy binary. Either they're completely gone, nothing left, memory only, a name on a headstone, and photographs in a drawer, or they're somewhere else entirely, tucked away in heaven, separate from your daily life, waiting patiently for you to join them someday in the far future. Neither one of those actually fits what the data points to when you look at it honestly, the way that we did last episode. I was raised in a Christian tradition that says that our loved ones survive death, which is very comforting. But again, the belief that they're in heaven, they're far away, or some religions teach that they're asleep until Jesus returns. Both of those things, they make them far away from us. Here's what I believe the evidence points to. They remain present in your life, not just as a memory, not just in your heart, not something that you just visit on anniversaries and quiet nights, as a presence you live alongside every day, as close as a thought, as close as your own breath. In fact, closer to people who are here with us physically has been my experience, because I have two daughters. I have one daughter in spirit, and I have one daughter physically. And my daughter who's physical, I think about her, but I don't feel her presence until she's actually in the room with me physically, which is not very often, you know, these days. She lives quite a ways away from me. She has her own life. But with Shayna, I feel like I can be with her at any time. And that is something that brings me great comfort, because even when I believed I was going to see her someday, I had this picture of like she was still somewhere far off. As I said earlier, every morning when I come out of my bedroom, there's that picture of Shayna waiting for me in the foyer, and I talk to her. That's how the day starts, every single day before I even put my shoes on to go for my walk, before I do anything else. And I keep going from there. Throughout the day, in the car, when I'm alone at my desk, I have her picture on my watch face. So whenever I look at my Apple Watch, I see a picture of her. I've got a picture frame in my office that's got pictures of Shayna. So I'm not doing this as a ritual for anyone else's benefit. There's no audience for any of this. In fact, I have an Apple Watch and no one even sees my watch face until I turn my wrist toward myself. So if I didn't tell anybody, nobody would know I even have that picture there. I talk to my daughter. I keep her present in my life because I believe, based on everything I've studied for decades and everything I've lived through since she passed, that she is still here for me to talk to. This is the so what of everything we built across all these episodes together. If the evidence means anything at all, it means this. You're allowed to keep the relationship going, not frozen in the past, filed under things that used to be true, not roped off somewhere in a faraway heaven that you only reach after you die yourself. Right here, right now, in your foyer, in your car, on your morning walk, wherever you happen to be when you need them. You've probably heard me say planted, not buried. That's not a nice phrase I made up for a greeting card. And it's not just something to say on a hard day to make yourself feel better. It's a description of what I believe is actually still happening. This is what living inside of that looks like practically. One ordinary morning, one photograph in a foyer, one good morning at a time. Repeat it for as long as I have mornings left to say it. I know you may be thinking, this is just a coping mechanism. You might think this is just a coping mechanism I built for myself, something to get me through the day that doesn't need to hold up to scrutiny. That's a fair question, and it's exactly the kind of question my chemical engineering brain would ask too. But that's precisely why we spent that entire episode on the evidence before we ever got here. I'm not asking you to talk to a photograph on faith alone. And if you do, that's fantastic. I'm not asking you to do that with nothing behind it. I'm asking you to do it because when you actually examine the research, the near-death experience studies, the accounts that meet a legal standard of proof as we talked about, the pattern that shows up across cultures and centuries, the practical conclusion is that the connection doesn't require a body in the room. That evidence gave me permission to do what my heart already wanted to do anyway. That's what makes this different from a comforting story I tell myself. It's actually a practice that I built on top of an examined conclusion, not instead of one. So when I am talking to Shayna, I am talking to Shayna. I'm not just doing it to make myself feel better. Now, I want to address something directly because I think it's an honest question underneath a lot of what I said today. What if I'm wrong? What if there's no one on the other end of the conversation at the foyer and I'm simply talking to a photograph in an empty house? Well, here's my answer, and it's the same answer I give in any area of my life where certainty isn't fully available to us. Even setting the evidence aside for a moment, even if I only have a 50-50 chance of being right, I'd still choose to live this way because of what it does to how I carry Shayna forward. Talking to her keeps her voice, her presence, her place in my family alive in a way that silence never could. And it cost me nothing to be wrong in this direction. It would cost me everything to assume the worst and to go silent instead. So this is kind of like Pascal's wager, right? the wager that you might as well live a moral life in case there's a God judging you at the end, because that's the better bet than living an immoral life and finding out that you're wrong. But I'm not just hedging a bet. I believe the evidence actually points to where I've landed. And that's the difference between hope and conviction. This isn't wishful thinking dressed up as spirituality. This is a conclusion that I've earned the right to hold, the same way I'd earned the right to hold any well-supported theory in any other part of my life. So when you build your own version of this, whatever your practice ends up looking like, whoever your person is, I want you to know this. You're not just being naive. You're not just practicing wishful thinking. You're not refusing to accept reality. I believe you're accepting a fuller version of reality than the one grief first hands you, the one that insists that gone means gone. I don't believe it does. And I say that based on the evidence and based on what I've lived since the first morning I walked in that foyer and decided to speak to Shana instead of Pastor. That's the so what. Four pieces, and I hope at least one of them turns into something you can actually use this week. Not something you just nodded along to in a drive somewhere. Let your rituals change purpose the way that my walks did. You don't need a new practice. You might just need to add a new reason for the one you've already done. The thing that you're already doing, just do it with a different focus. When a trigger flattens you, and it will, remember that's not a setback. It's love finding you again at a red light or wherever happens to catch you. Protect your grief from the people who need you to perform being okay, and go find the ones who will let you speak about your person the way that you actually experience them, in present tense, alive in your life, even now. And let the evidence we've spent all these episodes carefully building actually change how you live. If not, I've just wasted my time reciting all this to you. It's not just a comfort that you visualize occasionally when things get hard, but it's a presence that you carry with you, starting the moment you walk out of your bedroom in the morning. I want to leave you with this. None of what I gave you today is complicated. A longer walk, a shelf with a photo on it, taking a breath at a red light, a sentence said to someone, "I don't need you to fix this," a good morning said out loud to a picture in the foyer. None of this requires special training or money or anyone else's approval. And that's on purpose. The most important tools in grief are never going to be complicated because you don't have the bandwidth for complicated right now. And I know that from the inside, not from a textbook. So I want to give you simple, practical things that you can do. What I want you to take from this today is this. Theory that never gets tested against a real life stays theory forever. It sits on a shelf, interesting, maybe even comforting in an abstract way, but ultimately unused and gathering dust. The whole reason I do this work, the whole reason there's an after the storm at all, is that I refuse to let everything I studied stay theoretical the moment it actually mattered. I owed Shana and myself more than that. And I think you owe your person the same thing. Not perfection, not a flawless grief journey, just the willingness to take what you believe and actually live inside it. And you don't have to do this alone, and you were never meant to carry this by yourself. If today's episode landed for you, I'd love for you to come over and find me on Substack. It's grief to growth, grief the numeral two growth.substack.com, or you can go to grieftogrowth.com/substack if that's easy for you to remember. And on Substack, I go even deeper on everything we've covered across this whole series and will do in the future. And you can reach out to me directly if any of this stirred something for you. Until next time, I'm Brian D. Smith. Keep walking through the storm. There's something on the other side of it, I promise you, and it's worth walking toward. Thank you for spending this time with me on After the Storm. If today's conversation resonated with you, I'd love to continue the journey together. You can find more of my work at www.grieftogrowth.com. That's grief, G-R-I-E-F, the numeral two, growth.com. Until next week, remember, after the storm is where the healing begins.